uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, coast to coast, border to border, and beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live365's American FM, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program, or welcome to our program here this Wednesday, a beautiful day in May. The Iraq War now, 57% of Americans, 57% of Americans saying the Iraq War was, quote, not worth it. The number of Americans who do not believe it was worth it, the war in Iraq is continuing to grow. Now, just a week ago, that figure was 53%. In February, it was 48%. Something is happening here. People are starting to wake up in the United States. They're saying, this is not right. It's not worth it. It's not worth the deaths. It's not worth the problems. It's not worth the tragedy. It's not worth the injured people. It's not worth the 100,000 dead in Iraq. It's not worth the 1,700 dead Americans. It's not worth the 10,000 people in the United States who have been wounded. It's just not worth it. When are Americans going to start saying that other aspects of war and the war machine and all this sort of thing are equally not worth it? When are they going to start saying that, well, you know, this thing about nuclear power and all these nuclear weapons, maybe they're really not worth the price either? Helen Caldicott is with us. Helen Caldicott is the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, and right now the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is at the fore of the news. I wanted to get her take on that. Dr. Caldicott, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Tom. Can you hear me? You sound a bit bubbly. I hope your line is clear.
Oh, yeah, I can hear you just fine. You're coming through crystal clear. So and everything is we just had to switch studios here. I do a morning show in Portland, Oregon, and then I do this show the following 3 hours is a national show. And switching studios, we had to switch software and switch screens, and for about 3 minutes there, I couldn't even access your phone line. So we finally got it. So anyway, here you are, and I'm so pleased to have you with us. I said earlier when we spoke, you are one of my heroes, and you really are. I remember more than a decade ago, perhaps two decades ago, hearing you speaking on public broadcasting back when I was living in Michigan, as I recall, and just so eloquently speaking about the very real dangers, the real potential for disaster that not only our nuclear power systems have, but also our nuclear weapons development and systems and storage and all these things, really serious problems. Let's talk first about nuclear power, if that's all right with you. One of the arguments that has been put forward by the cons on this issue, and in fact was made on this program just a few weeks ago, we had one of these guys on from the Competitive Enterprise Institute or whatever it was, who was trying to tell us how everything is fine, nuclear power is green, it doesn't contribute to greenhouse gases, France is having a wonderful time with it, they get all their electricity that way, and we should too. Take a shot at that, please.
All right, you've got 103 nuclear power plants in your country, all of which are targets for terrorists. Inside each 1,000-megawatt nuclear power plant is as much long-lived radiation as that released by the explosion of 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs.
So we have a million Hiroshima bombs just in our nuclear power plants, 1,000 times 1,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
So now, sitting beside the reactors are things called cooling pools. They euphemistically call them swimming pools, in which are every year they remove 30 tons of the irradiated fuel rods. They're so full of radioactive elements, they're not efficient anymore, and they're very, very radioactive and very thermally hot. They have up to 30 times that amount inside the reactor core in the cooling pool. So that's 1,000 Hiroshima bombs multiplied by 30 in the cooling pool.
So we have 30... So we have 30 million Hiroshima bombs in all of our cooling pools.
Well, some you've got 10 times, some you've got 20 times, some you've got 30 times as much as in the reactor core.
Wow.
Now, those cooling pools are very vulnerable to terrorist attack. In fact, some of them are only protected by a roof the same construction as a Kmart roof.
Whoa, whereas you mean like a heavy-duty snowstorm could take them out?
A heavy-duty snowstorm, let alone a small aeroplane flying into it. Now, once the cooling pool is disrupted and the water gets out, those cooling pools burst into flames, melt down, and release all that radiation into the air. So we're sitting on a ticking time bomb, and the nuclear industry have taken no responsibility to strengthen the cooling pools, number one, or two, really protect them from terrorist attack. And they're, I mean, I just don't know why it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and let's hope and pray that it doesn't, but it is insane that we have this situation. What has brought us this?
Well, you know, I think what happened was when the men who made the first atomic bombs, I mean, Oppenheimer, who designed it, when he watched the first bomb blow up in the desert, and it was called Trinity, named after the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And when he watched it blow up with the heat inside the center of the sun, he muttered to himself, "I have become death, the destroyer of worlds," from the Bhagavad Gita.
Wow.
And they felt such guilt about killing up to 200,000 people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They thought that they could redeem their conscience by harnessing atoms for peace, and thus nuclear power was started in the 50s by Eisenhower. They hired a PR man, I think from General Electric, to sell nuclear power as being American. It was swathed in the American flag, Atoms for Peace, Sunshine Unit.
I remember it well.
Feet to meter. And it was a lie, and the scientists who developed it knew full well that you make a lot of plutonium, like 500 pounds a year in a reactor that lasts for 500,000 years and is the most deadly substance known to the human race, such that 1 pound, if evenly distributed, could give everyone on Earth lung cancer. And they knew that. Yet they kept on selling this to the American people as a benign form of electricity production. All a nuclear power plant does, in fact, is it boils water.
Yeah.
And the heat generated turns into electricity. The steam generated turns a turbine that generates electricity. So all it does is boil water, but make massive quantities of radioactive waste, which must be guarded, isolated from the environment for up to 500,000 years.
When we've only had what we call civilization for a few thousand years, and what we or some would argue a few hundred years.
Well, Jesus lived 2,000 years ago, and we think that's antiquity. He didn't even speak English. I mean, what sort of signs are we going to put on these radioactive waste dumps so our descendants don't dig into them? But inevitably, the cans will rust, the material will leak, and cesium and strontium and radioactive iodine and plutonium and all the rest concentrate in the food chain thousands of times at each step, like the algae, the crustaceans, the little fish, the big fish. You don't know when you're eating a fish that you're eating strontium 90. You can't taste, smell it, or see it. And when you get your cancer 20 years later, because the incubation time for cancer is a long time, it doesn't wear a little flag saying, "I was made by some strontium 90 you ate in a fish."
Right.
That was spawned in the Millstone reactor in Long Island Sound or whatever.
Yeah, so there's just no way of knowing. And the way this was sold to us was by a bunch of folks who, some of them were acting out of guilt and some of them were acting out of greed, bottom line.
Right. Oh, yeah, greed always comes into it. And in fact, you, the taxpayers, have subsidized nuclear power right from the beginning. You've paid for the enrichment of uranium, which incidentally in itself produces massive quantities of global warming gas.
Yes, let's talk about that for a moment.
Well, to enrich uranium, when you dig uranium up, it's a raw material in the earth. It's got two isotopes. One is uranium-235, and that's only present in 0.7%, and that must be concentrated to 3% to use in nuclear power plants, and over 50% you can make bombs with it. The rest is uranium-238. And to enrich the uranium, you have to push it either through a very fine filter or use a centrifuge system. And that's extremely energy consuming. So it takes 2 1,000-megawatt coal fire plants to enrich the uranium in this country. So that produces a lot of carbon dioxide. One, two, it's a very hot process. So they use chlorofluorocarbon gas, CFC gas, which we used to use in refrigerators, which we found destroys the ozone layer.
Like Freon.
Freon. And it's banned internationally now under the Montreal Protocol. However, the only industry in America now using CFC gas is the nuclear power industry, which is used to cool the pipes in the uranium enrichment facility. 93% of the CFC gas released into the atmosphere comes from leaking pipes at the uranium enrichment plants. And that CFC gas, as well as destroying the ozone, is up to 20,000 times more potent at trapping heat and causing global warming than carbon dioxide.
So let me get this straight. The major contributor right now, worldwide, the major contributor right now to the destruction of the ozone layer is nuclear power plants?
Well, in America, yes. Now,
in America, it's 93%.
In some of the underdeveloped countries, they still are using CFC, but on the whole, it's banned internationally. It used to be used to blow up styrofoam, you know, for coffee
sure.
cups and things, to blow up plastic for furniture and stuff like that. But it's all been banned now because, you know, it's in Australia, you know, where our ozone is desperately thin. We've got an epidemic of skin cancer and malignant melanoma because the ozone's so thin, and that's been caused by CFC or Freon gas.
This is startling and unpleasant information. So nuclear power is not green power. In fact, nuclear power is actually contributing to the destruction of the environment. Also, it seems just kind of common sense that there would be an enormous amount of oil or gasoline anyway, or diesel fuel used in the mining of uranium itself, in the transportation of it.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, huge amounts of oil and petrol are used to mine uranium. To mill uranium, that's another process, then the enrichment occurs, and then to build a huge reactor. And, you know, an awful lot of carbon dioxide is made when you make cement or concrete to make the reactor.
Right.
And then the reactor can only last about 30 years before it's so radioactive no one can go in there anymore. And then you have to cut it apart by remote control by robots because it's so radioactive, and that's all consuming fossil fuel, and then you've got to transport the radioactive waste maybe to Yucca Mountain for the next 30 years, like 1,500 shipments every year for 30 years through Chicago and the main, you know, ports and cities of the country, all targets for terrorists. And then you have to store it, isolated from the ecosphere for 500,000 years.
Yes, this just doesn't work. Dr. Helen Caldicott, the author of Nuclear Madness, Missile Envy, If You Love the Planet, A Plan to Heal the Planet Earth, A Desperate Passion, and her new book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. Is there a website, Dr. Caldicott, where people can find more information?
Yes, you can go to my nuclearpolicy.org website. I've got an institute called the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, and I set it up specifically to get on the media to debate with the right-wing think tanks like Heritage Foundation that spends $29 million a year on the media, American Enterprise Institute and the like, so we can teach people the truth.
Yeah, well, a good plan. Thank you so much. Dr. Caldicott, I want to get you back on one of these days soon and talk about nuclear weapons, the other half of this. We've run out of time. But this is a serious issue. Nuclearpolicy.org. And pick up Dr. Caldicott's new book, The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. Thanks so much for being with us today.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Tom Hartman program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend.
Whenever I hear that, I think that bumper, I think of the old Fire Sign Theater song. Back where... I'm not even going to try it. It's, anyhow, those of you who know the Fire Sign Theater version of this song, smile.
My old 44. Well, you sleep out every night, and the only law is right. back in the saddle again.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and participate in one of the most erudite, thoughtful, and sometimes weird and kinky conversations in the entire, all of cyberspace, the entire, what do you call it, the webosphere? I'm not sure. I'm sure somebody in the chat room will tell me. They are my external brain. Really. Occasionally, I say something really bright on this program, and I'll bet you thought I thought it up. Nope. Somebody says it in the chat room, I just repeat it. So if you want to know where the real intelligence is, just go to the chat room. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Tom, and is it Sylmar, California, Tom? Oh, got to push the on button here. Hey, Tom.
Yes, hi.
Did I pronounce it right?
Yes, you did.
Great.
I'm about 20 miles north of Los Angeles, and I want to welcome you to the West Coast, which is the best coast.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be living here, and I'm pleased to be on the air here. It's great. Loving it.
Well, thank you. You were chatting yesterday with a fellow who calls you because he's right sitting on the fence there between being a he doesn't want to be a Republican. But he's afraid of the.
I think he's waking up.
Yeah, I see a lot of people here that I who grew up in the same time that I did, who learned about government back when it was more popular, learning that in high school and things.
Yeah, actually, when it was required. I mean, it was just it wasn't so much it was required by some federal agency because we didn't have that, but it was just everybody assumed that an important part of getting an education was learning how to be a good citizen of your country, and being a good citizen meant you understood what the Constitution meant, you understood what the founders intended, you understood why the Civil War was fought, you understood about the labor struggles of the late 19th century, you understood about the Great Depression, you understood about the New Deal and how different it was from Herbert Hoover's vision for America,
right.
And you just got all that stuff. I mean, by the time you were out of high school, you got it.
But
not the case anymore.
Right. Well, I think it has to do with baby boomers putting on a kind of peer pressure with each other to learn the same things about how government functions and how you are a part of that. That's what President Kennedy helped to put into our brains, that, hey, you can do something about this.
Yeah, and in fact, I would say that Kennedy really helped drive that process, you know, with his inaugural speech, Ask Not What, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
His point was, you are the government. The government is not some distant entity. It's not some them. It's not like the Communist Party or something, or the Republican Party. It's actually us. It's we the people.
Yeah, and you know, I learned in history class about the weaknesses of the Articles of
Confederation,
Confederation, and why the Constitution helped to strengthen the central government.
Yep.
And that's what the neocons are taking pleasure in, starving it to death.
Well, and not only that, the Civil War, what the Civil War ultimately was all about, I mean, slavery and all those other things were involved in it, but ultimately what the Civil War became about was whether we were going to have a strong federal government or whether we were going to have strong states. And prior to the Civil War, we had strong states and a weak federal government, and after the Civil War, we had weak states and a strong federal government. It's been that way ever since, and that was essentially decided in the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
And end of discussion. I mean, a lot of changes were made, including three amendments to the Constitution, that threw into the federal realm a lot of things that the states had always considered their own particular rights as a result of 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. A lot of people don't get that, and the cons certainly don't get that, although it's really weird, because up until the last year or so, they had been the big advocates of states' rights, and now they're saying, oh no, the federal government should have the right to overrule states when it comes to things like abortion policy, or education policy, or health policy, or Social Security, things like that. All of a sudden, the cons have become the people that they were preaching against. It's absolutely bizarre. Tom, thanks for the call. Great to hear
good
from
you. Good talking to you, Tom. Thank
you. Yeah, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to our program. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you.
where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. At least the progressives in the control room over there, Heidi and Louise, scheming to take over the world, are you? Yes. No doubt about it. Welcome back, my friends. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Mark in St. Petersburg is on the line. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. This is Mark at JustSayNoToFascism.com.
Great. JustSayNoToFascism.com, one of my favorite websites.
That's correct. I have free bumper stickers, and I wrote the book, Just Say No to Fascism. I think your show is helping to save America.
Well, thank you, Mark. I hope so. Otherwise, all my efforts are in vain, because I'm not doing this for the money, I'll tell you. I'm doing this because I really and truly want to transform this country.
Well, that's the thing. We got to get the word out to the hardworking Americans out there. I mean, there's a lot of guys driving around in pickup trucks with W stickers on them. They love America. They just don't know what's going on.
That's
right. We've got a mad bus driver, and he's heading us for the ditch.
I know, and he doesn't understand even half the controls in his bus.
And
I mean, to extend the metaphor.
That's extremely dangerous. I mean, if we keep going the way that we're going, we could possibly have a depression in the near future. We could have widespread social unrest.
We could have a world war that ends all life on Earth, Mark. I mean, this is really serious stuff. George W. Bush, you know, he's like a kid playing with nuclear weapons. I mean, he literally is. And I seriously think that this guy doesn't understand the kinds of powers that he has the potential to unleash. Or if he does understand it, he's got this ideology that says, this deeply felt belief that says that the end of the world is just around the corner. Armageddon is this, you know, fire rains from the sky. 3/4 of humanity will be destroyed. There will be plagues and blah-de-blah-de-blah. You know, this Armageddon mentality. And he actually thinks that he's part of bringing that about. And that, to me, is truly frightening.
Yeah, I really don't want people running my country who don't believe that we have a future. I mean, this idea of using nuclear power, stepping up the nuclear power plants, militarizing outer space, designing bunker buster bombs that'll spread radiation all over the place, that's insanity.
Well,
that's,
and now we have
people.
Yeah, and now we have one of the nation's largest providers of stuff to nuclear power plants and to nuclear weapons manufacturers, General Electric, owning a television network that is running a TV show about the end days, about Armageddon.
Yeah, actually harnessing the media like that is nothing new. Goebbels did it in the 30s. We've had our own Reichstag fire with the 9/11 incident.
Yep. Yep.
Now we've got them threatening and killing news reporters over there. I mean, ask the Italians what's going on with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and they will tell you without hesitation, by the way. And that's another one of those stories that just is not being covered in the American press. Screaming headlines in Italy. Even Berlusconi is upset about this. And, you know, it's just a little too much trouble for CBS to tell us about it.
Well, it's conveniently not covered in our quote-unquote mainstream media.
There you go. Well said. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you there in St. Petersburg. And keep up the good work. Keep spreading the word.
You too, Tom. And that was an awesome book you wrote about Jefferson.
Oh, yeah.
What you were talking about with the tariffs and what it's done to our lack of an infrastructure and industry and productivity here, all our jobs going over to China,
yep.
Tariffs would have prevented a lot of that stuff.
Oh, yeah, and they did for 200 years in this country.
Certainly.
Yeah.
And it's a blind leadership that's gotten us into this mess.
It is, and we need to change that leadership, and it's only going to happen when you and I get politically active starting today.
And that's the thing. We got to get the word out. I mean, I've got bumper stickers for free clothing. Wear clothing. I mean, wear a hat that says your favorite progressive radio station. I mean, the activism, since the media's mainstream media is not going to do it for us, we need to, as individuals, start putting signs in our yard, start putting things on your truck, start wearing things to the grocery store, and talk to people. I changed the guy's tire yesterday. Never met the guy in his life. He said, I'm a stone libertarian. I said, well, me too. I don't want government messing with my life. You know what they're doing with the Patriot Act? We got to talk with people.
There you go. Well said. Mark, plug your website one more time.
This is JustSayNoToFascism.com.
JustSayNoToFascism.com. Thanks a lot, Mark. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Scott in Kalamazoo, Michigan on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Hey, I was just reading my local newspaper, and maybe you have some insight on this, that some major corporations or retailers that sell over-the-counter drugs are pulling them behind the counter because they have one of the ingredients is used to make methamphetamine.
Right, Sudafrin.
Is that an example of corporate, you know, being corporations being socially responsible, or is there some ulterior motive in there?
Well, no, it's what's been happening for years. There's this this chemical that they used to derive from ephedra, from an herb called ephedra. And, in fact, in herb shops, you can still buy it. It's the Chinese version is called Ma Hong and or ephedrine. And there's a chemical that's derived from that, epinephrine or epinephrine. There's various forms of it. And Sudafrin is the one, and I may be mispronouncing it, but that's how it's spelled, is the one that is chemically derived from this and or artificially manufactured. And that compound is the main antihistamine compound in the antihistamines that you take, or the anti-congestion, you know, the cold medications that you take, that tend to jazz you up a little bit. It acts like adrenaline in the body. It's sort of a noradrenaline. It's sort of a it behaves like adrenaline. It stimulates the body, but it also causes all the mucous membranes to contract, to constrict, to tighten up, and makes it easier for people to breathe, and dries out your throat and things like that. Although it does, you know, it also has a kind of a speedy effect, for which is why a lot of people don't like it. Well, that chemical is about 1.5 steps away from methamphetamine. And you can very easily convert that chemical, you know, not quite literally in a bathtub, but very close to it, with a few basic household chemicals and a couple of other solvents that you can buy, you know, pretty much anywhere. You can convert that into methamphetamine. And so these guys who are cooking meth, these guys who are making meth, what they do is they go down and they buy, you know, 100 or 200 or 300 packages of one of these antihistamines that's heavy in the Sudafrin or the epinephrine, and then they cook it into methamphetamine. And we have such a problem now with methamphetamine all over the United States. It's become the poor man's cocaine, and it's cheap to manufacture this stuff, that pharmacies at a local level are getting pressure from politicians and from citizens to do something about it, and so they're trying to make the raw materials unavailable. And so I think that that's actually an example of good corporate citizenship, frankly.
Well, I was hoping so. I was hoping that was the case, because I know some of the companies, if they didn't have a pharmacy, were going to stop carrying those products because they didn't have a place to put it.
Yeah.
So I thought that was the case.
But here's the bigger issue, though, and this is what's being missed, Scott. Yes, it's easy to cook this stuff into methamphetamine. I mean, there was a time when I was growing up, when I was a kid, you could walk into a pharmacy and over the counter you could buy codeine, which is an addictive narcotic. It's a derivative of opium. You know, it's an opiate. And there have been other drugs over the years. In contact cold capsules used to be, you could take all the little yellow pills out and you get belladonna out of them, and people would use that to get high back in the 60s, although it was fairly dangerous. You can't do that anymore. But the bottom line, really, with the more serious drugs like amphetamine, is that the addiction to amphetamine is a medical problem. This is a medical problem. And we really, I mean, it's fine to get the raw materials out of the way and try and diminish their availability. I'm not opposed to that. But what really disturbs me or concerns me is the fact that the cons out there don't want to even discuss. Let's put together treatment programs. Let's put together education programs. Let's help kids figure out what happens to their brains when they take amphetamine. I mean, that old ad, you know, this is your brain on drugs. Probably not so true about pot. You know, pot is, you know, yes, it does have negative effects, but it's nothing compared to alcohol. But methamphetamine, I'll tell you, methamphetamine burns brains. You look at the before and after PET scans, and the brain mass diminishes over time from using methamphetamine. This is a serious and dangerous drug, and that issue is not being addressed. And in part, I think it's not being addressed because we're giving this drug to our children as an ADHD medication, and in part, I think it's not being addressed because the just don't want to deal with anything medical. They'd much rather just throw people in prison, which is stupid and expensive.
Which is a whole lot easier, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it's easier. It just feeds an industry that supports the conservatives. It feeds the police industry, it feeds the police state, and it feeds the single largest growth industry in the United States right now, which is private for-profit prisons.
Well, and one other thing on a different subject, just real quick.
Sure.
I watched a PBS special last night about Karl Rove. The local station out of Grand Rapids had it on, and it was very upsetting to me and surprising, because had this aired a year ago, it should have been no surprise
how
he tactically was going to approach the campaign, and because he had done the same things before.
Was this Bush's Brain? Was this the one where they interviewed the author of Bush's Brain, the program?
They interviewed him for a few minutes, and some of the top political advisors and et cetera were on there briefly back and forth. It was definitely, you know, more not in a flattering.
Right. They talked about how he bugged his own office and when he was running Governor Clements' race in Texas. And
well, they talked they didn't get into some of the details that you have before. But it, just in general, if you'd seen that a year ago, the whole Swift Bowl thing would not be surprising considering what happened to McCain and Cleland.
Right.
Him using the gay issue like he had done previously. I mean, basically, the way he would run a campaign, some of the tactics he would use, if you'd seen this a year ago or anybody had done any research on him, should have seen some of this stuff coming.
Oh, yeah.
And that was really what was so upsetting to me is like, okay, if you got a PBS special that basically lays out how he runs campaigns, you know, from when he was back as a kid in I think it was Idaho, you know, it shouldn't have been a surprise some of the things they did. So why did they get away with it? That,
right.
That was
and,
upsetting
and,
to me.
And, you know, who hired him way early on back in the late 70s, early 80s was George Bush Sr.
Right.
And I mean, you know, this when he was head of the Republican National Committee, and this was before Bush and Reagan ran for office. This was must have been the 70s, was it? Yeah, it was in the late 70s. And Karl Rove and Lee Atwater were involved in that campaign where they did the October surprise thing and brought down Jimmy Carter.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And that, in my opinion, was a Rove operation, although he's never taken credit for it.
Right. Well, not only that, now what they're trying to do with the courts is the exact same thing that he did with the Texas Supreme Court.
Exactly.
You know, those decades ago. I mean, it's the exact same thing. I mean, it's little tweaks here and there, but, you know, it's the exact same process. So it baffles me that if the PBS, you know, which is still a little bit left-leaning, say, or centrist, you know, can dig this stuff up and put it together in a video, that, okay, why couldn't the Democrats do that last year and say, this is what this guy does?
Well, I can tell you,
that.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question, although I can tell you that PBS is probably going to be moving on from this because PBS now is being run by this Tomlinson guy who is Karl Rove's old friend. Karl
right.
Rove's childhood friend is now in charge of PBS.
Well,
and
they
have put
of that.
Six of the nine commissioners on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting are now Republican hacks and appointees. They're not people with broadcasting experience. They simply have Republican experience. You know, collectively, they've given nearly $1 million to Republican causes over the years. And this one guy, Kenneth Tomlinson, is Karl Rove's old friend. I mean, it's just absolutely bizarre.
And I had thought about that because at the end it said that he declined to be interviewed for it, and it occurred to me that, you know, a year from now they may run a special on him in a completely different light.
You betcha. In fact, I would predict it.
Portray him as a hero.
There you go. I absolutely predict it. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you.
Time.
I appreciate it. Yeah, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Steve in New Jersey on the line. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Short time listener, big time fan. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Nobody's commented on this yet, and I saw that it broke about 11 o'clock or so. A coworker of mine was showing me a website. It's not smokinggun.com, but something similar like that. And what it shows is our favorite racist and anti-Semite, Pat Buchanan. Ready for this? And this is a police record and a Washington Post article. His father was arrested in 1952 for an anti-Semitic incident in which he and two others spray-painted anti-Semitic and swastikas on a Bethesda, Maryland synagogue.
Is Pat Buchanan's father was arrested.
Pat Buchanan's father. And again, you know, the sins of the father, that whole thing. But you at least know the household that Pat Buchanan grew up in.
Yeah,
and
well.
It's even more entertaining. You ready for this? The judge offered Pat Buchanan's father the opportunity for Holocaust sensitivity training or a 90-day jail sentence. He opted for the 90-day jail sentence.
Wow. Steve, that's incredible. I'm going to drop you here because your line is breaking up really badly. But thanks for calling and sharing that with us. We took our kids to hear Pat Buchanan. This was back when he was running for president many years ago. Our kids are all grown ups now. You know, they're all adults, but they were children at the time. And the oldest was a teenager, and the middle one was just hitting his teen years, and the youngest was seven, eight, something like that. And I said to them, if we lived in Germany in the 30s, I would want you to have an opportunity to hear Adolf Hitler, because you have to understand how the other side functions. You have to understand how they're behaving. This guy is running for president. If he becomes president, this country could go in a very, very dangerous direction. I want you to hear what this is like. We took our children to the Cobb County Civic Center. It was packed. It was standing room only. It was full of skinheads. It was full. And Pat Buchanan got up there and did an incredible rant. The guy's a brilliant public speaker and actually made some good points, some very good points with which I agree. But the vast majority of his speech was devoted to the international banking conspiracy and those people, which is a code phrase largely for Jews, those people, in at least the context that Buchanan was using it, who control the international banking system, and their, you know, this was his whole rap. And it was the I was stunned. Louise and I were standing there going, why hasn't the network news reported on this aspect of Pat Buchanan? Why is it that this guy's on TV every single night on all the on all the cable shows and so often on the network shows, and nobody talks about the fact that he's a screaming, raving anti-Semite? And I was there. I heard it. I can tell you, it was freaky. It was scary. And I think the reason why, of course, is because there are large chunks of the Republican Party who think that that's just fine, thank you very much, and the media is afraid to go near it. The media is so intimidated by the Republicans and the conservative Democrats that when one of their own, you know, one of their guys, Pat Buchanan, gets out there and starts these kinds of rants, as he was doing on the campaign trail, they just don't want to talk about it. And there were reporters there, and they never reported on this stuff. Well, how do you report on it? Pat Buchanan was talking in code today. Maybe that's what they didn't want to say, but it was so transparent. It was so obvious. Steve, thanks for the call. 1-866-889-8894. We'll pick up your calls right after this break. It's Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
We're just living our American dream. The CEOs are playing for the Bush-Cheney team. My president, he got you all scared. The billionaires are coming, so you better beware. Step out or stretch hummus and everybody stands. Parents, lock up your daughters. Here come the billionaires.
It's the billionaires for Bush.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're dining on
Look out.
We're dining on Sprouts. Yeah, the
it's the billionaires for Bush.
These federal contracts just land in our lap. We keep getting away with all the craziest crap. We're ripping off the Pentagon.
Yes, welcome back. The billionaires for Bush once again. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Jeff in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey. I just wanted to ask you about how I could implement some policies from Paul Hawkins' book.
Which book? Natural Capitalism?
Natural Capitalism, right. Because my office where I work, my business, I mean, they have a whole bunch of paper that they print up each day, and it all goes in the garbage. And in his book, there was a premise about a technology that said you can recycle ink off of paper. How could I go about finding how to tell them how to implement?
I don't know. But I know that the Rocky Mountain Institute, which Paul Hawkins was affiliated with back when he wrote that book, I think he no longer is, but they that's Amory Lovins' group, Amory and Hunter Lovins. They carry on that work, and I would check out paulhawkins.com, Paul's website, and Rocky Mountain Institute, I believe it's .org. Certainly you could Google it, Rocky Mountain Institute. And because what the Rocky Mountain Institute does is they go around and they do consulting mostly to corporations on how to do these kinds of things. And so my guess is if the information is out there, you'd find it on one of those two websites.
All right. What's his name said, Pat Buchanan said was so bad. I agree that if he just said those people, that doesn't necessarily mean he's referring to Jews. There is an international banking conspiracy, and they're controlling everything pretty much.
Well, you know, I'll give you that there is, that the banking industry as a whole controls a whole lot, and they have an enormous amount of power. You would have had to have been there. There was no doubt in my mind or anybody else's in that room who he was talking about, and he has a long history of it. There's a reason why Pat Buchanan is referred to so often by people as being anti-Semitic, and it's not just because of that one reference.
Okay.
So, yeah. take my word for it, Jeff. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And keep on the good work. Carry it on. That said, by the way, I've got to say, I actually thought about recommending Pat Buchanan's book, Where the Right Went Wrong, as one of my BuzzFlash books of the month, and discussed it with Mark Carlin, and we decided not to do it just because the last chapter of it was so toxic. But Pat Buchanan's book, Where the Right Went Wrong, he takes apart George W. Bush. So what can you say? I mean, well, you can say he's an anti-Semite. Yeah, I'll say that. Or he certainly appears to be, in my opinion. And occasionally he says something useful. So I guess we have to take what we can where we can. Tom Hartman here with you.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour, in another 5 or 6 seconds. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Amid rising nuclear tensions, more than 180 nations are working together on the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. Washington and Moscow, according to this treaty, are supposed to slash their number of nuclear warheads. And yet, at the same time that this is going on, this very delicate negotiation that would say that the United States, Russia, and Israel have to reduce the number of warheads that they have, that the Pakistanis and the Indians have to eliminate their warhead programs, that the Iranians and the cannot develop them, that the North Koreans, if they have them, they have to dispose of them. These very delicate negotiations, at the same time that this is going on, the Bush administration has announced, as is reported in the Japan Times. Now, why do you have to go to the Japan Times for this? Well, it's a sad commentary on the American media, but here from the Japan Times, Dateline Washington. This is being reported from Washington, D.C. by a Japanese news reporter. But, you know, Dateline Washington in the Japan Times. The U.S. military is considering allowing regional combat commanders to request presidential approval for preemptive nuclear strikes. Preemptive nuclear strikes. Now, the Test Ban Treaty, the ABM Treaty, all of these treaties say you can't, well, actually, every international treaty that we are a party to says no nation can do a preemptive strike unless they can demonstrate to the world that they are so threatened that this is the only way they can survive. The U.S. military is considering allowing regional combat commanders to request presidential approval for preemptive nuclear strikes against possible attacks with weapons of mass destruction on the United States or its allies, according to a draft nuclear operations paper. In other words, if a country has the weapons that Don Rumsfeld sold to Saddam Hussein, our friend, the guy that Don Rumsfeld is now trying to, now we learn, has recently tried to cut a deal with, you know, if you'll just denounce all these attacks, we will let you go into exile, Mr. Hussein. And Saddam says, shove it, Donnie. No thanks, not going to take it. Don Rumsfeld, the guy who used to negotiate with Saddam Hussein, caught on videotape shaking Saddam's hand as he was over there back during the first Bush administration, or during the Reagan administration, over there selling Saddam the weapons of mass destruction that he so wanted to use against the Iranians, because back then we thought the Iranians were our enemy because they had thrown out the Shah, who was our handpicked CIA stooge. And so we had the Shah, our CIA stooge in Iran, along with Saddam, our CIA stooge in Iraq. And we were giving Saddam the weapons of mass destruction. So if a country now simply had the things that Don Rumsfeld sold to Saddam Hussein, and God only knows how many other countries Don Rumsfeld sold those weapons to, you and I certainly will never know. It's classified, after all. one of the reasons why when Saddam released 14,000 pages of notes on the destruction of his own weapons of mass destruction, the United States redacted 5,000 to 6,000 pages of it, wouldn't share it with the United Nations. Why? Because it was a list of the companies in the United States and the politicians in the United States that were doing business with Saddam in the weapons trade, a.k.a. also known as the Reagan administration. So now if a country simply has some of the weapons that we sold Saddam, we can hit them first with a nuclear weapon. In fact, specifically, the paper identifies nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons as requiring preemptive strikes to prevent their use. Requiring preemptive strikes to prevent their use. There are numerous non-state organizations. Excuse me. This is from the Doctrine for Joint Nuclear Operations, a March 15th draft paper by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I am quoting from this Joint Chiefs of Staff document. The Doctrine for Joint Nuclear Operations says it is guidelines for the joint employment of forces in nuclear operations for the employment of U.S. nuclear forces, command and control relationships, and weapons effect considerations. And then it goes on to say there are numerous non-state organizations. That would be like Al-Qaeda and about 30 nations with WMD programs, including many regional states. End of quote. The paper says in recommending that commanders in the Pacific and other theaters be given an option of preemptive strikes against rogue states and terrorists, and says suggests that they should request presidential approval for use of nuclear weapons under set conditions. Allowing preemptive nuclear strikes against possible biological and chemical attacks would effectively contradict a Clinton administration policy. This was the negative security assurance policy declared 10 years ago by the Clinton administration during an international conference to review the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Are you getting this? The Pentagon says this is just a draft. It still has to be finalized. Yeah. We have a ways to go in this country, I think, before we can have any assurance that we are safe and secure. And the biggest problem right now in terms of what is going to make us safe and secure and what is the threat to safety and security in the United States, the biggest problem right now is in the White House and in Congress. We have people who really think that strike first and ask questions later is a good policy. And look where it got us in Iraq. If we had just waited another few weeks, that's all it would have taken, another few weeks for Mohammed al-Baradei and Hans Blix to prove to us in the world that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. If we had only waited an extra few weeks, but that was too much for George W. because he had to have his war because it was part of his 2004 campaign strategy. And so he had to go charging in there without U.N. approval, without you know, Resolution 1441, which was passed by the U.N., explicitly said that the U.N. and its member states would not attack Iraq until there was a clear finding by the U.N. In other words, until the weapons inspectors came back and said, yes, there are weapons in that country. And as it became increasingly obvious to the entire world, and now we find out that Tony Blair was lying to his own people about this, as was Junior, as it became increasingly apparent to the entire world that there were no weapons in Iraq, Bush had to stop that inspection process dead in its tracks and go rushing in. I'd like to share with you just a few thoughts from Senator Jim Jeffords of Vermont. He will not be in the United States Senate after 2006. He's going to retire. Bernie Sanders is going to run for his seat. God bless him and good luck. And here, Jim Jeffords, some of his thoughts on George W. Bush. This is one of the more important commentaries, I think, of our day, frankly.
I have opposed the Iraq operation from the beginning, and as time goes by, things are getting worse and worse. And I cannot believe that we are willing to give away the resources of this nation in such a cause that presently has not proved to be very worthwhile in the sense of its goals.
This from a Republican. Now, you know, I should qualify that, the only Republican I've ever voted for, but a Republican nonetheless, Jim Jeffords, a Republican, saying on public broadcasting, he's first asked a question by the folk by the fellow from Vermont Public Broadcasting, and then he answers it. Jim Jeffords, one more time, the former Republican senator, now independent senator from the state of Vermont.
But does the situation now in Iraq essentially show that he made the right decision?
I don't believe so. I was against it at the beginning, and I'm still against what invading Iraq. I think it's created huge problems. I feel that we should never have gone in there. I think it was all done to get oil. I think that that's the end result is going to be some oil agreement. And to the loss of life that we had and to the cost of it was, to me, just a re-election move. And
just a re-election.
Try to live off it and probably start another war. Wouldn't be surprised next year. Probably in Iran.
This is the United States Senator.
You think that's likely?
Oh, I probably shouldn't even talk on it. I just feel so bitter about the thinking that's gone on behind them and the reasons they go to war and went to war. But I feel very strongly that they're looking ahead and that there'll be an opportunity to go into Iran and try to get their son elected president. I don't know, but to do it each time they want to have a new president. I'm very, very, yes. Oh, well, I better be quiet.
And at that point, Jim Jeffords self-censored. He decided, okay, said enough, and didn't want to go there anymore, because you take on the Bush family, as Mike Malloy likes to call them, the Bush crime family, you take them on at your own peril, particularly if you're a Republican or a former Republican. Rick in Grand Rapids is on the line. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, I was listening to the conversation in the just last few minutes, and I was thinking of that saying. I believe it was a man named Stephen Decatur who said, "My country, right or wrong." Remember that?
Yeah.
Well, if you have a little history in mind here, you think about probably going back to the time of when the Soviet Union first came about. They weren't recognized by the United States government until 1933 when Roosevelt came in, and then they were the bad guys for a while, and then they were the good guys, and we were fighting Hitler. Then they were the bad guys again, and then China came along, and then they were the worst communists. But then, because the Soviet Union was stronger, we played the so-called China card, and we go back.
Right. 72, you know, Nixon. Yep.
Yeah, and the thing of it is, you know, Germany, Japan, and Italy are enemies in World War II, and, you know, rightfully so, of course, and Russia and China are allies, and the war is over, and everything's reversed. China and Russia are the enemies now, and up to a point, you know, you figure, well, yeah, these are bad regimes. Now, I think you and I can agree that Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, North Korea, these are all bad regimes, but Pat Buchanan, in one of his lucid moments when he quotes John Quincy Adams, the United States does not go in search of monsters to destroy, because if we do, there's no end to it, is there?
That's right. That's absolutely right. And that was the point of his book, Where the Right Went Wrong, and an eloquent examination of it, actually.
At what point, when you're searching for monsters to destroy, do you neglect your own home, you know?
Yeah.
So I mean, it'd be like a father who took care of all the problems in the neighborhood except those of his own family. And
well, this is why George Washington, in his farewell address, warned us. I mean, one of the most significant warnings, one of the most powerful statements that came out of that was warned us against foreign entanglements. Don't get messed up in the politics of Europe. Don't get messed up in the politics of other nations. Don't do it. We have enough problems here at home. Thank you very much.
The Monroe Doctrine was stated that we did not want any countries interfering in our hemisphere, but I guess we forgot to come up with a doctrine to say that we would not interfere in theirs.
Yeah, it's
because the other can be just as bad, and of course I know you know about Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial.
Oh yeah, and in fact I play it on this program probably so frequently that my listeners have it memorized. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear
Keep
from you.
The good work.
I appreciate it. Thank you. You too. Keep spreading the good word. 20 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman here with you, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy. What a novel idea. Democracy to the United States.
You're listening listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Ellen Ratner's with us, our correspondent, our bureau chief, our friend in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi, Tom. It's interesting. Yesterday there was the BRAC hearings, and this, of course, is the base closure and realignment commission. And they started yesterday talking about intelligence briefings on threats. Now, there's a very interesting situation, and I don't think I told you about it yesterday because I think it just happened afterwards, but it has to do with the governors and whether they will have a right to veto the let's say the BRAC commission says we're going to get rid of two National Guard spaces per state.
Right.
Or one per state. Do the governors have a right to veto the BRAC? Because, in fact, the National Guard is technically under the direction of the governor.
Right. Although, so, tell that to the governor of Montana or the governor of Washington State, some of these governors out here in the West who are saying, hey, wait a minute, we've got fire season coming, we're having droughts because this global warming climate change stuff is changing things around, and we need our National Guard because they fight the fires and they're all in Iraq.
Right.
What are we going to do?
Exactly. Okay, a couple other interesting things. The Bush administration is, of course, doing their thing this morning, or they did their thing this morning, meeting with the Hispanic Business Caucus. And interestingly enough, the folks in the Democrats have just recently had a conference call. They had Congresswoman Grace Napolitano and some other folks. And they're really saying that this Latino coalition of the president just doesn't have it right, that the Social Security is really going to fall on the middle class, that his plan, and that basically that his attempt to put this small business conference in Washington together is just not really meeting the needs of that conference.
Wait a second, maybe I missed something. Is there a Latino coalition that's supporting Bush's Social Security privatization program?
Oh, yeah, he put together a coalition.
Oh, somehow that slipped right by me.
Oh, no. This is the Latino Coalition Small Business Conference.
Huh.
And, in fact, they're making such a big deal of it that they even sent out something in Spanish that Ken Melman is speaking at that today.
That's incredible.
And tonight, they are having at the White House a Cinco de Mayo, which Clinton did too, a Cinco de Mayo celebration. In fact, one of our colleagues, Blanquita Cullum, is going to dinner at the White House tonight as part of the Cinco de Mayo celebration that the White House is doing for their version of the Hispanic community.
Yeah, we should add that Blanquita is one of our right-wing colleagues.
That's right.
None of the left-wing colleagues are going to be invited to the White House.
No. So that is really, I mean, it's interesting the pitch that they are really, I mean, Ken Melman, they're sending him out big time to meet with everybody. Speaking of Ken Melman and company, there's gossip in town that Karl Rove actually went to meet with Catherine Harris to discuss whether she was really going to run for Senate or not in Florida.
Yeah, I had heard that, and that he was trying to talk her out of it, basically, because she's just too much of an embarrassment to the party. She did her thing. She was a useful idiot. She stole the election in 2000 for George W. Bush by purging the electorate rolls. She had her term in the House of Representatives. She should now go away because she's been paid off.
Exactly.
Yeah, but she doesn't want to go away. She has political ambitions.
She does have political ambitions, and I'll tell you, she is one woman who I know her quite well, will get what she wants.
You wonder if they're going to take care of her the same way some suggest they took care of Osama bin Laden's brother, Salam bin Laden, the guy who bailed out George W. Bush's Armbusto oil, and as soon as that started getting investigated, he went down in a plane crash.
I'm
over the edge, aren't I, Helen?
You're there.
I like to poke it every now and then. It's like a harness.
The other thing I just want to tell you about,
sure.
I think I told it about you a little earlier, which is the visitor center is going to be almost $600 to $700 million at the Capitol.
Right. This is so that you can see a Disney World version of the Capitol, since they won't let you see the real Capitol.
You
security,
got
you understand. We live in a brave new world. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Ellen. Ellen, hang on. I'm going to put you on hold. I think Louise wanted to talk to you. Thanks so much. 29 minutes past the hour.
A party at Ed's house. Okay. Will Ed's parents be there? Then the answer.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. No, we are never going back to con rule again in the United States. I'm telling you, there's a demographic shift, a psychographic shift, a political shift happening. The Democratic Party, the Greens, the Progressives, the folks who really and truly hold a vision of democracy for America rather than a vision of a belligerent, autocratic, theocratic country like the cons and the Republicans are holding, the progressives and the Democrats, the liberals, here we are, that we are on the upswing. And my only hope is that as the cons go down, and these cycles happen in the United States, they have, you know, 5-6 times now since this country's founding, as this cycle happens, that the cons don't drag us into more wars to try and prolong their rule, because it's very clear to me that both the Afghan war and the Iraqi war were simply campaign stunts for George W. Bush, and a deadly ones at that, and they continue to be tragedies for our people. Xavier in California on the line, our number 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Xavier, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman Program. What's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. I wanted to ask you about something that's going to be on C-SPAN, but first I wanted to make a quick comment about the precursor drugs or chemicals for things.
Right, for amphetamine.
Illegal things, yeah.
Yeah.
I do research on fuel cells and other things. I'm one of these kind of like Steve Jobs or, you know, not on that level, but, you know, garage scientist, basically.
Right.
And I'm finding it increasingly difficult to get, you know, lab glassware, hydrogen, platinum group catalysts and stuff like that.
Right.
And there's a balance here. So I just wanted to plug that as well.
No, I absolutely understand. And probably there are some folks out there who are doing research in these areas and who are also finding that they're getting a knock on the door because, hey, why did you order, you know, 5 gallons of hexane? That sort of thing. My son is working on his master's degree in biology, and they're finding strange limitations and weird, you know, stuff that traditionally had not been regulated is starting to be regulated in ways that are making it difficult for scientists to get stuff.
Yeah, and it could be used for political things too, especially if you're not fitted into the industrial kind of structure for doing these things. But anyways, I wanted to talk about something else. I wanted to ask you about. I was listening to, I think it was Mike Malloy's show, he was talking about, I think today sometime, it's supposed to be a guy who spoke at in Madison, Wisconsin about 9/11. Are you familiar with this guy? He talks a bit about Bush knew kind of things and stuff like that. And it sounds a little bit like a conspiracy, but I like to keep an open mind.
Well,
do you know anything about that?
You know, I'm not sure which guy you're talking about. There's a bunch of them out there. I've read several of their books. I've seen a bunch of their DVDs.
You know what? I might have his name here.
Yeah. But the bottom line is, of course Bush knew something was going to happen. He got 56 different intelligence briefings that told him that there were terrorists in the United States, that they were going to hijack airplanes, that they were going after high-profile targets in the Northeast, probably in New York City and Washington, D.C., that, you know, I mean, this stuff, and he got on the notorious August 6th presidential daily briefing that it was Osama bin Laden, and he was determined to strike inside the United States. But then we learned after the election, I mean, they held this off until January. The 9/11 Commission didn't release it until after the election. But we learned after the election that over 50 times before 9/11, Bush and Rice and Rumsfeld and Cheney had been warned that these guys were going to do 9/11.
David Ray Griffin is his name.
Yeah, David Ray Griffin. Yeah, I, you know, so, I don't know him personally, okay. But you know, I know of what he's, and he goes beyond what I'm saying. I mean, obviously, you know, but I can't speak for him, and I'm not going to try to. But speaking for myself, I'll tell you, there's no doubt in my mind. George Bush knew something terrible was going to happen. That's why he wouldn't go back to Washington D.C. Yeah. He got that presidential daily briefing on August 6th, and boom, he went on the longest vacation in the history of the presidency. And even then, he wouldn't. When that was finished, he wouldn't go back to Washington D.C. He went to Florida to hide out with his brother.
Okay.
So, yeah, of course Bush knew. Of course Bush knew. I mean, the 9/11 Commission says Bush knew. Nobody's disputing that Bush knew.
Some of the things this guy talks about are the World Trade Center coming down vertically, and it looks like there might have been things...
controlled demolition and stuff, yeah. And then the Building 7 actually is the one that, I'm still scratching my head over. I can't
figure
it out.
Building 7 actually sounds less conspiratorial to me. Well, I mean, you know, there's... And then the plane... maybe there was no plane that actually hit the Pentagon.
Yeah, I saw that. There's a video of that on the web, and I saw that, and it's floating around. And on the other hand, you know, there are hundreds of people who have said that, you know, who were on the highways that day. Hey, the plane flew over the top of my car.
I'm just trying to tease apart the really wacky ideas from the ones that might hold water, because I think sometimes people mix the two together and they discredit real things that might be happening.
I agree, and that's why I'm saying, okay, I have an open mind about whether or not the Bush administration, how much they knew. You know, did they know specifically that this cell was an Al-Qaeda cell, that it was going to strike in early September, that it was going to strike New York and Washington? I think there's a reasonable probability that they actually knew at that level of detail.
Yeah.
Did they know that it was going to be the World Trade Center on 9/11? Frankly, I doubt it. I think that they knew that it was going to come, and they knew it was going to come within a matter of a few weeks. And they did nothing to stop it. Dick Cheney was in charge of the Counterterrorism Task Force, which never met before 9/11. And of course, it was the Saudis who were doing this, and the Saudis had George W. Bush, had Jr. by the throat. I mean, Jr. has his company, Arbusto Oil, the shrub in Spanish, oil company, was going down the tubes, and who bails him out? Salim bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's half-brother, his sole representative in the United States, gives the money to George to bail the thing out.
That's the guy that just... died in a plane crash?
Yeah. Once they start investigating this stuff, the right wingers had their, you know, okay, Bill Clinton and Vince Foster and all the murders that happened around Bill Clinton and all that stuff, and the left wingers have their all the people who died around George W. Bush and stuff, and frankly, I don't know the truth or non-truth of either of them. I'm very suspicious of both of them, but in my mind, just the fact of the public records, just the fact that these guys knew what was going to happen broadly and did nothing to stop it. That is an indictment. Bill Clinton knew that there was something up, and he did stop it. They stopped the millennial bomb attacks. They stopped those things. They did, and Bush failed. This was the biggest intelligence failure in the history of the United States. And what do we do? The Bush administration promotes the woman who was in charge of intelligence, the National Security Intelligence Advisor at that time, who was responsible for the biggest intelligence failure in history, promotes her to Secretary of State. And Bush himself, who was theoretically in charge of the whole country at the time of the biggest intelligence failure in the United States, he gets reelected. Go figure. As I said, here's the other part of my conspiracy nut theory. I don't think he was reelected. You know, I believe that the exit polls were right, just like I believe that they were right in the Ukraine. Why is it the exit polls in the Ukraine were 5 points off? The exit polls in the United States were 5 points off. In Ukraine, it was a stolen election. Here, it wasn't. I don't think so. But that's another rant. Xavier, thanks for the call.
Okay.
You know, get me started here. Whoa. Tim in Illinois. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tom. I love it when you get started.
Yeah.
Greetings from one who ran screaming in the streets in college when my fellow students were killed and injured by Ohio National Guardsmen.
Yes, today is the anniversary.
35 years ago on this date.
Yes, today, May 4th, is the anniversary.
And no one has been held accountable to this date.
Yeah. Were you there in Ohio when that happened?
I was not. I was here in Illinois at college.
Yeah.
And it was such a disturbance in our campus. There were, of course, the National Guard was called out.
Yeah.
And the president of this school closed the college, and we all went home.
My recollection is that the same thing happened in East Lansing, where I was. But there was a trial, you know. There was a trial that was held where they put the National Guardsmen on trial afterwards, and they decided that they were not guilty. There are a lot of questions about that trial and who authorized ammunition and things like that. This is an issue that... I'm not sure it needs to be reopened now, but we do need to remember that the government of this country really must be answerable to we the people. And when the government, as it did under Nixon, as it did to some extent under LBJ, got away from being answerable to we the people, then what we ended up with was the government killing we the people at Kent State, and it was a terrible tragedy.
Absolutely. Well, that is not the main reason I called it. I called today to follow up on some of the things that you just ranted about.
Okay.
Yesterday, I had a chance to question Barack Obama after a
press in person.
Yes, after a press conference in Central Illinois. I spoke to him as a progressive citizen of Illinois, and I asked him things that the press is not asking him.
Uh-huh.
First of all, why did you vote against the bankruptcy bill amendment for a 30% interest limit on credit cards?
Oh, cool. What did he say?
Obama, quote, "Well, that was part of a tactic to help defeat the bankruptcy bill, which I voted against," end quote.
What?
I was just dumbfounded. He didn't elaborate, but I suppose the tactic was to allow the bill to be so egregious that no sane legislator would support it.
Did he ultimately when all was said and done at the very end, did he vote? He voted against the bankruptcy bill or in favor of it?
Against it, but his rationale for rejecting Dayton's amendment was that this was part of a tactic to ultimately help defeat it.
Well, you know, there may be some validity to that. Maybe the Democrats actually believed that if they created a bill that was so transparently toxic that the Republicans would be afraid to vote for it. They just didn't realize how sick and twisted and sold out the Republicans are.
That's what I thought, too, but you saw what happened. This all, if that was the tactic, it backfired, and
yep.
now we've got this awful bill.
Yeah.
I also asked him why. I'm glad you just ranted about this. Why did you support the appointment of the most inept national security advisor in the history of the United States to be Secretary of State?
Obama, and he said,
Obama, quote, "I don't agree with that. Condoleezza Rice represents the president. What choice did we have? Wolfowitz? Rumsfeld?"
Yeah.
End
well,
quote.
You know, he does have a bit of a point there in as much as the president sends down his national security advisor for nomination.
Yes, but I was prepared with the follow-up question.
Okay,
which
great.
Is, well, why not vote on principle? Isn't principle important? Obama, quote, "I'm not there to act symbolically. I'm there to get things done," end quote.
Interesting.
Now, in other words, in his world, voting on principle isn't an option. His strategy is don't fight the big important battles for Americans. Just let those things go by. Instead, get these purported victories here and there for constituents in Illinois to optimize your chances of being a career politician.
Interesting.
Now, another one, I think that's a very, very, very revealing comment by him. Another one, why did you vote to support the fraudulent election results in Ohio, Obama? Quote, "Look, the election wasn't fraudulent. George Bush won by 2 million votes," end quote. Question.
Not in Ohio.
"Did you read the Conyers report, and do you think it has merit?" Obama, quote, "Yes, I read it, and I think there were a lot of things going on there, but not enough in Ohio to change the election," end quote.
Huh.
Now, get this. In response to a question by someone else, Obama said he will support CAFTA because, quote, "the South American companies don't have much manufacturing, so there won't be much displacement," end quote.
Oh, my God. You're
of course,
kidding.
This was a reference to jobs in America without actually saying the word jobs.
Yeah.
I consider it an insult to the intelligence of any thinking person who was there, because it presumes that the multinational corporations are not going to take advantage of the new resource for cheap labor.
So Barack Obama is the new DLC Democrat on the block.
Well, you know, I was going to ask him, are you now part of the DLC? But he started to get really irritated with me. He was not pleased with the questions I asked him. I don't think anybody asked him these questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most of the reporters' questions at the press conference were about what Obama and our Republican congressman, Ray LaHood, are doing to keep military bases open in Central Illinois, as though that's a burning issue in the minds of people who live and work in Central Illinois and are getting ripped off every day by the Bushites.
Well, for the people who work at the military bases, it is, and they can be outspoken. But, yeah, good point. Tim, thanks for sharing that with us.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay,
incredible. Absolutely incredible. Barack Obama, the new DLC Democrat. 1-866-889-8894. Tony in Michigan on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. If I remember right, Barack Obama was running against Alan Keyes, right?
Yeah.
I know Barack Obama's been a little bit of a disappointment, but I would rather have him over Alan Keyes any day, and I thank Illinois for their choice.
Yeah, so I'll give you that, Tony. I'll give you that. But, you know, why settle for half a loaf when a whole loaf is really what we need?
Well, get a better one next term, but right now I'll take him over Alan Keyes.
Yeah. Okay. Was that your point?
That's pretty much it.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Tony. I appreciate it. Tony makes a point, and that's, you know, we have to be practical and pragmatic. And that's the point, I think, that Barack Obama was making to Tim when Tim was asking him these questions. However, there is a time when you need to stand up and say, hey, this is what I think is true. This is what I believe in. And it doesn't necessarily require that you behave in a way that is totally consistent with what you're saying. Now, this may sound very strange to those people who think entirely in terms of black and white. But I, for example, in the 2004 election, I will be the first to tell you that there are a number of things with which I disagreed with John Kerry on. You know, I didn't think that John Kerry's position on national health care was anywhere near strong enough. He wanted to involve health insurance companies. I think that they should all be put out of business. I think we should have single-payer health care in the United States. We already have it in the form of Medicare. We should simply make it universal. Just as one example. I mean, there's a whole long list of things with issues where I disagreed with John Kerry. And yet I voted for him. And I voted for him because I felt that George W. Bush represented such a danger to America and continues to represent such a danger to democracy in the world, to peace in the world, and to the safety of myself and my children, that John Kerry at least was not toxic. Bill Clinton, by and large, at least was not toxic, although his NAFTA and WTO GATT thing was a crime against America. A crime against the world. It was the surrendering of sovereignty to the multinational corporations. But nonetheless, he was less toxic, George Herbert Walker Bush, certainly, and less toxic than Bob Dole was. So, you know, sometimes you simply have to take an action that is halfway because the alternative is worse. But you can still stand up and speak out and say, okay, this is only a halfway action I'm taking, folks. And we need to go better than that. We need to do better than that. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. As the framers wrote into the preamble of the Constitution. CAFTA, a big win for progressives. David Sirota reports this on his spam email, whatever you call it. It's probably on his blog as well. There's good news and bad news about CAFTA. The good news, David reports, is the new House Democrat coalition. And I don't know why they don't call it the new House Democratic coalition. This bugs me. But anyhow, the new House Democrat coalition has come out against the Central American Free Trade Agreement. They've come out against CAFTA. The group, which has been courted for months by pro-CAFTA business groups, thankfully decided to come out in defense of America's middle class and oppose this corporate-ridden pact. Let's be clear, says Sirota, this has at least something to do with progressives' renewed willingness to pressure moderate Democrats to start standing up for ordinary people. Yes, indeed. The new Democrats were hammered for supporting the credit card industry-written bankruptcy bill, and this is a terrific sign that they're starting to go in a much better direction. They should be roundly applauded for their announcement today. Special thanks go to Representative Ellen Tosher, a Democrat of California, who Congress Daily reports not only is opposing the deal, but will whip other new Democrats to oppose it. Now, whip is a word that, you know, it's used in Washington to mean, I mean, outside of Jeff Gannon, is used in Washington to mean lobby and push and encourage and nudge and hassle and, you know, yeah. Clearly, Jeff Gannon and whoever his secret friend in the White House is It has a slightly different meaning, but in any case. The bad news, the newsletter also reports that the House Minority Whip, that would be Steny Hoyer, the Democrat, said Tuesday in a news conference that no decision had been made as to whether the Democratic leadership would whip against CAFTA. So here you have the new Democrat coalition, the kind of the we're centrists Democrats. They finally come out and said, yeah, we'll go against CAFTA. But the head of the Democrats in the House, he's not willing to say it, even though most Democrats are against the deal. Hoyer also refused to whip the Democrats against the bankruptcy bill and when it came right out and supported the Australian Free Trade Agreement, even though that had a deal in it that made it impossible or difficult for Americans to import cheaper medicine from abroad. So somebody needs to get to Steny Hoyer and say, hey, Steny, get with the program. Wake up. America's changing under your feet. It's time to become a progressive. It's time to advocate for the middle class of America, for the working people of this country, rather than the wealthy millionaires, billionaires, and bimbos of the world. We have enough of them.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. A recent article in These Times, one of the sponsors of this program, by the way, by senior editor David Moberg, talks about the vast and underused reach of union media. The ILCA, the International Labor Communications Association, is currently in the midst of its annual media contest. And Alec Dubrow has looked at hundreds of these publications, and let's get his take on it. Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's with all these labor publications? I know two of my three brothers are union members. In fact, both of them are the equivalent of shop stewards, although they have different titles these days than just the old-fashioned shop steward. One's printers in the printers union, and the other in the electricians union. And they get these newsletters, and I've seen a lot of these newsletters over the years, and I see a lot of them, particularly from my brother John, the printer, because they print them also for the other unions around there. And some of them are kind of hokey, and some of them are actually quite informative, and some of them, you know, they seem to run the gamut, in my experience, over the years looking at them. What's your take on what's going on with the state of media and labor right now?
Well, they certainly do run the gamut, and they have a wide range of funding and a wide range of talent behind them. But the broad picture is that labor media is the best-kept secret in the media. And as Moberg says in his article, if you add up the audience for all the progressive independent press, liberal blogs, Pacifica radio stations, and I'm afraid yours as well, it probably isn't more than a few million households. But if you add in the labor press, the audience soars by an estimated 8 million more households.
Right.
That's a lot. But at the same time, the downside is, he says, yet the labor press wields little clout, even with union members themselves. Could this sleeping giant, if awakened, play a role in the revival of labor unions and progressive politics? Well, we're certainly hoping that is. And when you ask, you know, what's the story with them? Well, there's lots of stories. And they, as I pointed out, they range from glossy publications with multi-hundred thousand circulations to stapled and photocopied newsletters. And I've edited local and national union publications myself, but I'm kind of new in this job at the ILCA, and I'm just beginning to get an idea of the scope of it. You get to hear some great stories in this thing. The famous playwright David Mamet once gave a talk to my union, the Writers Union, in which he said, the history of labor is the secret history of the United States, and I'm just beginning to get an idea of the scope of it. You get to hear some great stories in this thing. The famous playwright David Mamet once gave a talk to my union, the Writers Union, in which he said, the history of labor is the secret history of the United States.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, it's still secret. But it's secret only because people don't bother to look, not because it's being hidden from anyone. So by looking at labor media, you know, you may have to plow through a bunch of stuff and pictures of conferences and pictures of presidents that you don't want to see, but you'll run across stories that simply aren't being covered elsewhere. And that's what's great about it. Plus, they can be fun. Some of them have great names, like Checkout is one of the Grocery Clerks magazines. Overture is the L.A. Musicians. The Widget is the airline pilots. Flight Log is the Association of Flight Attendants. They have humor in them. They have some talent. They can be interesting. And there's a lot of stuff.
What's the therefore for most of our listeners in this?
Well, first of all, yes, in terms of advertising, it depends on the publication. Some of them have had a policy of not accepting advertising because, after all, they are basically funded by the organization itself. There are independent papers as well that cover labor, but even among union papers, there is advertising in a great many of them, and certainly they reach one. You can practically bet that your audience is employed if you're advertising to reach those people.
Right.
And two, you can focus it a little better than if it were just a general publication for the community. So, yes, you can.
Okay. All right. I'd like to move along from this because even at that, I'm guessing that probably less than 1% of our audience is ever going to buy an ad in anything. So, looking like thousands of union workers at United Airlines are going to strike over the airline moving to wipe out their pensions.
Yes.
This is the big new thing right now all across the United States. We have these big corporations, in many cases multinational corporations, in many cases just mammoth American corporations, who are going to the pension, I forget the acronym now, for the Federal Association or the federal agency that guarantees the Federal Pension Guarantee Corporation, right?
Exactly.
And they're going to them and they're saying, okay, you, the taxpayers, you take on our pension liabilities. We're not going to do it anymore. And then you get companies like IBM, for example, who are shifting from guaranteed pensions where, you know, you're going to get a certain amount of money for the rest of your life into programs like George W. Bush wants to shift Social Security into, where basically you put in money and you get your own money back. Maybe it's appreciated, maybe it hasn't, basically turning them into 401k kind of programs.
Mm-hmm.
What is the trend here? What can people do about this? Is this, first of all, with United, do you think that this is going to stand? Do you think United's going to take down United? Is this going to take down the union? What's going on with this?
Well, you know, I mean, the whole airline industry is going through this in one fashion or another. Will it take down United? I think the example of Eastern Airlines some 20 years ago is an unfortunate and powerful reminder to the unions, in which they stood firm in a kind of restructuring like that, and the airline went under. So I do.
But I would suggest, Alec, that Eastern would have gone under whether the union had stood firm or not. Eastern was crumbling. I mean, this was the consequence of the deregulation of the airline industry. It was the old shock therapy thing.
Well, you may very well be right, but I think that the lesson that hit workers in the airline industry was that their actions, that they couldn't take an absolute stand. Many of them believe what you're saying. Many of them believe that, in fact, you have to understand that unions encompass everyone, and within that, there are many people who simply don't like the union's militant stand. And that in this case, I think, you know, it's entirely possible that the union may bend on this. Whether United, but like you say, there are many other factors other than the pension, other than the wage level, other than collective bargaining that have to do with whether United will stand.
Yeah, I mean, the question in my mind is, how is it that Southwest Airlines, which is the most heavily unionized airline of all the airlines in the United States,
exactly,
more of its employees are unionized, and as a...
There are many other factors other than the pension, other than the wage level, other than collective bargaining that have to do with whether United will stand.
Yeah, I mean, the question in my mind is, how is it that Southwest Airlines, which is the most heavily unionized airline of all the airlines in the United States,
exactly.
More of its employees are unionized and as a percentage than in any other airline. Southwest Airlines is the most profitable airline in the United States. And the last time I said this on the air, somebody called up and said, well, that's because they got a deal to buy gasoline. No, I'm sorry. They've been the most profitable airline for years, mm-hmm. and they have been the most heavily unionized airline for years. This, in my mind, is big corporations and the complicit mainstream corporate press, particularly the Wall Street Journal, out there trying to suggest to the American people the subtext, oh, it's the union that's bringing them down. We need to do away with those nasty unions. How dare the workers think that they should have democracy in the workplace? And, in fact, it's not the union bringing down United. United's bringing itself down.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. But what they think is, and some workers think, is they could at least buy some time by giving back some money.
Well, they should buy some time by getting new management for the airline.
And the matter is, the American public was not suffering greatly when airline fares were regulated. When I was young, there were three airlines, TWA, American, and United, that flew to many of the same places. The fare was the same on each one.
Yeah.
And I did not notice people picketing the place, say, please deregulate and give us a complex fare schedule.
No, and in fact, the one of the parts of the regulations was that you have to, that the airlines have to serve underserved markets, and they have to do it at a reasonable price. And now you find people who live in out-of-the-way places. I mean, I lived in Vermont, which is for, mm-hmm. Kind of a backwater, as it were. And people who live in out-of-the-way places, to get anywhere costs a fortune. If you live in a small city, and it's nuts. What we have is we have been brought the worst of all possible things. And this is, again, I don't want the government regulating the cost of my shoes. I don't want the government regulating my pant sizes or, things like this. And I certainly don't want the government manufacturing them. But when we're dealing with things that have to do with the commons, and transportation, right. In my opinion, is part of the commons, the government should pick sizes or, things like this. And I certainly don't want the government manufacturing them. But when we're dealing with things that have to do with the commons and transportation, right. My opinion is part of the commons. The government should be playing a role in that, because the government is us, and we should decide for ourselves how we want that commons operated. And if the airlines were to operate as public utilities, more or less, and provide transportation, and we guaranteed that they will always be profitable, not obscenely profitable, but profitable, we guaranteed that, I think it would be a good thing. Historically, the example is that it had been a good thing.
I think I agree with
but
you.
But instead of having that conversation, the Wall Street Journal wants to talk about the unions.
Yes. I mean, it's much easier to attack people. It is much easier. And the truth of the matter is, this is not deregulation. It's re-regulation. It rewrites the regulations in favor of investors, and it rewrites the regulations in favor of rapacious capitalism. But there are regulations.
Well, that's an excellent point.
Yes.
That's an excellent point. Let us never forget. That's an excellent point.
As Ralph Nader said about free trade.
RCAonline.org. Alec, thanks so much for being with us today.
You bet, Tom. Take care.
I appreciate it. We'll talk to you again.
Bye.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Is United Airlines a person? No, somehow I think not.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
And welcome back, my friends. I can tell you what it is. It's right-wing talk radio. That's what's wrong with the world today. And the cons and that follow them, and the politicians who pursue the agendas, and the poor, poor deluded folk who occasionally even show up in otherwise rational chat rooms to spout right-wing vitriol and rhetoric. Anyhow, welcome back. Hey, there are complaints going into the FCC now, I understand, about Laura Bush on national television discussing man on animal sex. This is what Rick Santorum warned us about when he warned us that if gay marriage was allowed, that soon you would have humans marrying animals and having sex with them. And here now you have Laura Bush telling us that, in fact, her husband, who I had thought, I mean, all the press reports said he's afraid of horses. He won't go near horses. That's why there aren't any at the ranch. That he, you know, but she says, no, he actually was having a good time with a male horse. And so anyhow, there's some folks who think that that's obscene. And the American Family Council, perhaps, the Christian Right, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, filing complaints with the FCC. Somehow I doubt it, frankly, it's them. But there are some folks who are filing complaints with the FCC about Laura Bush's indecent joke. When will this end? When will this end? It's over the top. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Sean in Indianapolis on the line. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. Hey, where can we hear all of Laura Bush's antics now? I mean, is there any place where we can listen to the Washington Correspondents' Dinner and then her little encore yesterday?
I don't know. You could check out C-SPAN.org. I somehow doubt that they have that on there, but it's possible that they do. The Daily Show had actually some of the longer clips on it, and the Daily Show does a pretty good job of keeping archives on their website. So I would suggest...
We just have to shove it back in their face. Look, you know, if they're gonna regulate the airwaves this way, then when you do something like that,
I have to say, Sean, I'm a little reluctant to do that, frankly. I think that because somebody else is acting outrageous and insane and stupid, that doesn't mean that we should do the same thing.
No, I know, but it'll show them how outrageous, insane, and stupid that the regulations are.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do with comedy. I mean, you know, just making a joke about it. And there's, you know, this email.
People don't understand comedy.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I mean, obviously, Laura Bush does not know the definition of comedy.
Well, her speechwriters actually did a pretty good job. What they're doing is and it's very, very calculated and very efficient, very effective. They're humanizing George W. by making, well, he may be a mass murderer. He may be a guy who has killed 100,000 Iraqis just to get himself reelected. He
but
may be a guy. He may be a guy who laughs about the people that he puts to death in Texas. But his wife is a sweetheart, and so I guess we can cut him some slack. That's Karl Rove's new strategy.
Well, I did want to call and tell you, though, I was looking through the radio guide here in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have nine religious-based radio stations.
It's a very profitable business. It is one of the most profitable businesses in America right now, selling
and
religion.
Out of those, three of them are talk, and I'm not even including the Disney.
Yeah.
The radio.
No,
Disney.
And Pat Robertson sold Christian Broadcasting Network. He sold it for $1 billion in cash.
Oh.
$1 billion in cash, something that started out as a little UHF TV station.
NPR actually did a scary Walmart story this morning on the morning edition. I was really surprised.
Well, just wait, good old Mr. What's his name there, the guy who's in charge. I don't have the paper in front of me here. The guy who's now in charge of Corporation for Public Broadcasting, doing his witch hunts, and it's just, you know, six out of the nine Corporation for Public Broadcasting trustees, or members of the board of directors now, are Republican hacks. Most of them with no experience in broadcasting. They're just there to be enforcers of fair and balanced. I have a bad feeling. Yeah, thanks a lot, Sean. I have a bad feeling about the future of PBS. 29 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind disks, I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks.
There you go. We can see through your masks, Mr. Masters of War, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Bush, Mr. Wolfowitz, Mr. Fife, Mr. Rumsfeld. We can see through your masks. We can see that you are willing to sacrifice the lives of human beings in order to hold political power. And we are sickened by it. And we are going to change it. We are going to get active politically. We are getting active politically. America is awakening. America is changing. America is saying, hey, enough, enough. We would like our country back. We would like democracy back. We'd like to have a middle class in this country again. A strong, vibrant, vital middle class where if people go into the workforce and they do their work and they put in their 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and remembering that May Day, which we just celebrated, was the fight, was a protest for the 8-hour workday back in 1886 when in Haymarket Square in Chicago, the police came in and others. There was a bombing and they arrested a whole bunch of union folks and convicted them for conspiracy that had nothing to do with the bombing. Conspiracy because they were members of a union. And they were protesting for the 8-hour day. And we would like a middle class back. Thank you very much. You want to have a middle class in the United States? Middle classes are not normal things. Economically, the middle class is not a normal thing. The normal thing in a, quote, free economy, end quote, is that you have big fish and little fish and nothing in the middle. The little fish can avoid the big fish, but the big fish can eat them whenever they want, and that's it. And there's no middle fish. Sorry. Or if there are, they're few and far between. They're like the guilds of the old medieval ages. The few who band together into the early forms of a union, they're the ones that make it and survive. But otherwise, no, they're toast. We would like our middle class back, please. And the way to get it is to organize labor, is to create democracy in the workplace, is to say this is what we stand for, and to say we want a strong social safety net. We want Social Security to work. We want Medicare to work. We want Medicaid to be fully funded. We want programs. Yes, we think people should pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and we want to give them some bootstraps when they don't have them so they can pull themselves up. And then there have to be jobs waiting for them when they get there. And they're not going to be waiting for them if all these folks go to China, if all these jobs go to China. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mark in Dallas on the line. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
Yeah, a cautionary tale and some good news. I've been listening to you for several years. After 5 years, I've finally found employment.
Well, congratulations.
Yes.
You're the fellow who was unemployed, who has like all sorts of graduate degrees, and you were in the military, and you were like the perfect employee, and your job got outsourced, right?
You got it.
Yeah. So you found a job, Mark.
5 years.
Congratulations. Well, so you know, are you making a livable wage?
Yes.
Oh, that's great.
Decidedly. I'll be moving back into part of the country that you just vacated.
Oh, yeah, you're going to move up to the Northeast?
Yeah, going up to Syracuse, New York.
Oh, that's marvelous. So you're in engineering, I'm assuming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's a great thing. And if we had a rational trade policy in the United States, people wouldn't have to wait 5 years to find a decent job.
Exactly. It's been catch-as-catch-can for the last 5 years. It's been miserable, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's nothing I think that any of us would want to experience.
Exactly. You know, after having gone through the experience, I mean, I really, really appreciate what hard times can bring, and you know, how people have to pull back to get through. And it's just so sad, as you're saying, that the middle class is being squeezed so heavily.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark, thanks a lot.
Take care.
Yeah, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you, and congratulations. This is wonderful news. Wonderful news. And I, you know, although while you're at work, you may not have an opportunity to listen to the program, it is archived at White Rose Society. They play it 24/7, and RadioPower.org replays it also in the evenings. And so you can still listen to our show. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. I wanted to make a couple, 3 points. One, yesterday I punched down a local big boomer here that's right wing to catch the bottom of the hour, and their clock must be just a little different than y'all's because I caught the last minute or so of Rush's segment, and he was saying, and this is as close to a quote as I can get, was that, well, blacks today must not know what to expect when they're watching the newscast because they're either going to be all downtrodden, but if they pull themselves up, like Judge Moore
and Bill Cosby, then they're going to be castigated as blackocracy.
Yeah, see, this is I have warned you about this, Roy. I'm telling you, these guys were going to play the race card with Janice Rogers Brown.
One wacko is another wacko, you know.
Yeah.
They're just different colors and different sexes.
And, yeah, the bottom line is it's got the opposition to Janice Brown has nothing to do with the fact that she's black, nothing to do with the fact that she's a woman. It has to do with the fact that she believes that the Social Security Act and the other reforms that were enacted in 1937 that controlled corporations, constrained corporate behavior, that created environmental protections and labor protections and workplace protections, that all of that was our socialist revolution and that it should be rolled back. That's what progressives object to in Janice Rogers Brown.
Then while all the slimeboat liars that are running the ads are saying she was reelected, she was not elected, she was retained, and there's a big difference. There's about a 95% retention rate on any judge anywhere, and I think she had like a 75%. Keep her in office. She hadn't screwed up bad enough to throw her out.
Are we splitting hairs here, Roy? What's the difference between being reelected and retained? I mean, if I reelect Bernie Sanders,
he's
retained.
She's not running against anyone.
Oh.
You know, okay. So if you know.
So
I've
it's a plebiscite. It's like Saddam Hussein when he ran for president.
Yeah. Well, it's a retained to the bench. She would have had to been rejected to be taken off the bench. Then somebody else would have been named to her spot. She wasn't running. It wasn't her running against somebody.
Oh, boy. Thank you for educating me about
that. And I think that was on America Progress. I could be wrong, but it's out there. And a couple other quick – there was two big anniversaries this week. And I know you touched on Kent State this morning on your morning show, but I don't.
Yeah, and we talked about it briefly. We had a caller in the last hour who brought it up. Yeah.
But one of the big anniversaries that I completely missed, I don't know why Fox wasn't headlining it and everything else, was earlier this week was the second anniversary of the aircraft landing.
Yes.
I mean, there
why
was
didn't
not
I headline
a
it?
Mention. I did not see it. I didn't hear it on your show. I didn't see it on Buzzflash. I didn't see it even on our side. And it was like it just didn't happen.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And
I'm actually
like,
looking for the clip right now.
God. It was May 2nd. I had posted a Guardian article up on the message board a couple days ago because I knew it was early May, and I got to poking around. I went up on this day in history. You know?
You're right. Well, okay, Roy, in memory of that, let me share this with you right now. Just listen here. Here we go.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
There you go.
Yeah, that had to have been, what, about
it's 2 years
12,
ago.
1,300 deaths ago.
Yeah, it was 1,700
probably,
deaths ago. Yeah, 1,500 deaths
probably
ago.
Probably 50 or 60,000.
He goes on. Let's hear what else he says here. This is just another minute of this.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
Yeah, right.
There
and
he
still
goes
on.
Yep.
He's that terrible morning.
Conflating them again.
19 evil men.
Anchor them together.
19 evil men. 15 of them from Saudi Arabia.
Oh, man.
Gave America and the civilized world a glimpse of their ambitions.
15 of them from the country whose leader he was holding
terrorist.
The hand of this last
that
week.
September the 11th would be the beginning of the end of America.
Disgusting.
This is incredible.
By seeking to turn our cities into killing fields, terrorists and their allies believed that they could destroy this nation's resolve.
I am so embarrassed.
And force our retreat
country.
From the world.
That there
they have
that
failed.
Many people. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Say that again, Roy.
I'm just so embarrassed for my country that there's still 50 or 46% of the people that believe me.
Yeah, that
and
still...
That is just so sorrowful that there's that many purposely, intellectually dishonest
ignorant people out there.
Well, let's cut them a little bit of slack, Roy. Most of those people, the vast majority of those people, and I know some of them. I mean, I have family members who are among those people. So most of those people are people who are working so hard just to keep their heads above water. They don't have time to pay attention to the news, and when they do watch the news, they're either watching the network news, which never has taken Bush to task and never has pointed out that he's a liar, or they're watching Fox News, which is even worse.
I would tend to agree with you, except that when you put it in their hands and they purposely deny it, that's the disappointing part.
Yeah, but by and large, their worldview is fixed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I know.
They saw it on the news. It must be true. And Karl Rove is such a master of manipulation. I'm willing to cut Americans a lot of slack, and perhaps the reason why is because I lived in Germany for a year, and I know, I mean, to this day, I know Germans who were on both sides, let's say. I have a good friend here in Oregon and Rudy out in New York who have both been on my program, both Rudy and Armin Lehman, who was Hitler's last courier. He was the 13-year-old kid who brought Hitler the message that the Ninth Army had collapsed and Hitler went off and committed suicide. And Armin wrote a book called Hitler's Last Courier about that. He's been on this program. He'll be on again. And he lives here in Oregon. And Rudy out in New York, who was in the Hitler Youth, they both have said, you know, absolutely, they've renounced this and, you know, the horrors of what happened. And then on the other hand, when I lived in Germany, I knew people who are the same age as Armin and Rudy, who to this day still think that Hitler's biggest mistake was that he invaded Russia a year too early. And you know, they believed it. They bought it hook, line, and sinker. And they're decent people, other than the fact that they're Nazis. And I realize that sounds like an incredible contradiction, but you have to understand the power of propaganda.
And that is what stymies me. Is even though I think I know I can't comprehend it. I think I know it, but I just can't comprehend it.
Yeah.
It's on a rational basis. I can understand it.
I am continually baffled by it. I mean, my mother and father have George Bush's picture on the wall in their living room next to the picture of me shaking hands with the Pope.
Yeah. So,
and, you know, I can't explain it. I just can't explain it. And they have listened to this program for, you know, a lot. They may be listening now. Hi, Mom and Dad. Figure.
Documented. And it's like this whole church-state battle. And the founding fathers were so crazy. You know, it's like, wait a second. And no matter how many times, how many different ways that you come at it, no matter which rep system you're using to work to convince them, until the emotions change, they'll never change their beliefs.
Well, the way to change those beliefs, the classic belief, challenging beliefs and changing beliefs in NLP, the way to change those beliefs is to find those areas where the belief behind the belief, the meta belief, or the belief that this is a meta too, actually, the core belief, where the core belief that they have is the same as the core belief we have. We both love our country. We both believe in the ideals of democracy. We both believe in freedom. We all believe in individual.
Morality.
Yes, absolutely.
I've been hammering is where's the morality
in
what? No matter what comes up, where's the morality?
Yeah.
Because it is so.
And then you build from that. But there are going to be some folks, Roy, and I think my parents probably fall into this category, who've simply been Republicans all their lives. And, you know, one bad apple, George W. Bush, is not going to be enough to cause them to abandon the Republican Party. And at some point, you just have to say, okay, you know, there's always going to be, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% of Americans who are going to vote that way. Our job is to find the people who we can convince.
In the middle.
That's right, who are in the middle, and say, hey, come on over to this side.
And solidify our base and make sure that they're getting the debatable points. The in and out, and to where when people bring up,
give people the tools,
the facts, to where they have the counter arguments. That's why I go up and spend time looking at WorldNet Daily and Sludge Factor and whatever.
Yeah,
because I want to know how they're reframing it. Because I know what I read today is going to be on talk radio tomorrow. It's just the same as that, the black, you know, attack going for the race card. That was right out there.
I know they were advertising. Roy, I got to move along, but I appreciate the call and the excellent points that you make. A group of here's our caught you doing something right. In fact, do I have that music? I do. Hey, there we go. Congratulations! A group of wealthy Vermonters say, "Tax us more." Now, this is not to say that I'm totally in favor of taxes in all cases, but I do think the government should pay its way. And if we, the people, decide that there are services that we want, if we want to have fire departments, if we want to have police departments, if we want to have social services, if there are things that we want, if we collectively decide that we want to give big welfare checks to multinational corporations, if we truly decide that in a democratic process, then we should pay the bill for it. And a group of wealthy Vermonters, Vermont is looking at an $80 million Medicaid deficit, have put together a program whereby the state can raise from them $90 million. Plan calls for an increase in the personal income tax for the top 5% of taxpayers. It eliminates the 40% exclusion on capital gains income. It repeals or postpones corporate tax cuts enacted in the last session and institutes a sales tax on professional services and increases the property transfer tax on sales of property over $300,000. Congratulations to these folks. They've come up with a group, in fact. It's called Southern Vermonters for a Fair Economy and Environmental Protection, otherwise known as SVEEBP. And Joan Berkowitz of the group says, "We are here to say that the wealthiest Vermonters in every town are willing to be taxed at a higher rate to avoid cuts in human services, environmental programs, and the state's infrastructure." Congratulations. God bless you, all you great folks at SVEEBP.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Early in the evening, just about supper time, over by the courthouse, they're starting to unwind.
Welcome back.
Walking on the corner, trying to bring you up.
Just when you thought it was safe to come out. Down on the corner, the cons are at it again. I'll tell you, they're at it again in the White House, in the Congress, in the Senate, in the House of Representatives. This is from David Sirota. After the passage of the credit card industry-written bankruptcy bill last month, you probably thought Congress was through screwing average Americans, at least for a little while. Well, you were wrong. Now we have the Responsible Lending Act from Ohio Congressman Bob Ney. A Republican, surprise, surprise. Though Ney is from the state with the highest foreclosure rate in the country, he's working to make sure banks can continue ripping off unsuspecting consumers. The bill essentially cements into law the rights, so-called, of predatory lenders who seize on financially vulnerable Americans who have less than perfect credit records. This is a $9 billion a year industry. And it appears to me, I'm not quoting here David Sirota, this is my take on it, it appears to me that Congressman Bob Ney is in their pocket. I would invite Congressman Ney to come on our program, our telephone number 866-889-8894, and explain this. Apparently, as David Sirota says, these sharks want to cheat hardworking people out of even more of their home equity. And the supposedly up-from-your-bootstraps Republicans are helping create a system that actually kicks people in the face as they're earnestly trying to climb the ladder. Here are the two worst features of Ney's bill. Number one, it raises fees. The bill allows lenders to tack on another 2% in fees on subprime loans offered to people with less than perfect credit. Next, it penalizes people for succeeding. The bill allows lenders to charge exorbitant penalties for paying off a high-interest loan early. Oh, you thought you could pay that off early and avoid all that interest? Well, they'll just take it from you in a fee. Essentially locking buyers into high-interest loans even if they get out there and earn the money to pay it off. Additionally, as the Center for Responsible Lending notes, it actually lets banks, quote, pay bonuses to brokers for steering buyers into expensive loans. In addition, it hides exorbitant fees and surcharges, it limits consumers' rights, it preempts state laws that protect consumers. There's got to be, there should be a law against lawmakers like this. What is with Congressman Bob Ney of Ohio? Well, I can tell you what's with him. There's some cash in his pocket, I'll bet on it. Thanks for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. See you then. Keep the faith, friends. Keep fighting. Don't ever give up.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivil Nikolic.